Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments, historical what ifs.
Today, we're tackling a question that sits right at the heart of the American identity. It's a question so fundamental, so profound, that just asking it feels like changing the laws of gravity. What if the American Civil War never happened?
It's almost impossible to imagine, isn't it? 4 years of brutal conflict, over 700,000 lives lost, a nation literally torn in two. For me, growing up, the Civil War wasn't just a chapter in a history book. It felt like this foundational scar on the national psyche. You can't understand America without understanding that war, and the idea of removing it from the timeline, well, it's a fascinating and, frankly, a daunting thought.
It really is, and my fascination comes from a slightly different place. I'm obsessed with the mechanics of it. What would it have actually taken to prevent it? Was there a political path, a compromise, a moment of leadership that could have steered the country away from that precipice? We're talking about defusing a powder keg that had been filling for decades with the explosive issues of slavery and states' rights.
Exactly. It's not just about erasing the battles. It's about rewriting the entire political and social DNA of the 19th century. So today, we're going to venture into that alternate past. We'll explore the how, the potential peaceful resolutions that were whispered about but never realized. And then we'll dive into the consequences.
And those consequences are staggering to consider. A United States that never had to go through the crucible of war and reconstruction. How would that have shaped its path to becoming a world power? What would the journey for civil rights have looked like? The questions are endless, and the answers could lead us to a world that is, for better or for worse, completely unrecognizable.
Exactly. Unrecognizable. And before we get lost in that alternate future, I think we have to grapple with the how. You brought it up, the mechanics. Was there a single moment, a single decision, that could have diverted this runaway train?
That's the billion-dollar question. Because it wasn't one thing, was it? It was 100 different pressures building up. But if I had to point to one area, I'd look at the economics. Specifically, the South's supreme and ultimately misplaced confidence in what they called King Cotton.
Ah, yes. The idea that Europe, especially Britain, was so dependent on their cotton that they'd be forced to support the Confederacy, or at least pressure the North to back down.
Right. But what if that leverage was a mirage before the war even started? The historical record shows that when the South embargoed their own cotton, hoping to force Britain's hand, it backfired spectacularly. Europe just found other sources. Egypt, India. What if that shift had happened, say, in the 1850s?
So, a global market that had already diversified away from the American South. The king is suddenly just a regional duke.
Precisely. Imagine Southern diplomats in 1860 trying to make threats. And the British response is essentially a polite shrug. We're quite all right, thank you. Our mills in Manchester are running just fine on Egyptian cotton. That fundamentally changes the South's calculation of its own power, doesn't it?
It completely deflates their entire diplomatic strategy before it even begins. Without the perceived international support, without the economic blackmail, does secession even seem like a viable option? It becomes a much, much bigger gamble.
A much lonelier one. Because their whole theory of victory wasn't just military. It was economic and diplomatic. Take away the diplomatic card, and suddenly you're just a small agrarian rebellion against a burgeoning industrial power. The odds look a lot longer.
But does that stop the underlying cause? I mean, the passion, the ideology behind secession was about more than just cotton exports. It was about preserving a way of life built on slavery. Would a weaker economic hand have cooled those passions, or just made them more desperate?
That's the counter-argument, isn't it? That a cornered animal is the most dangerous. Maybe a South that feels its economic power slipping becomes even more radical, more entrenched in its defense of the institution of slavery as its last unique asset.
It could have accelerated the crisis. They might see the writing on the wall, that their influence is waning, and decide to act sooner, before their position erodes completely. So a weaker King Cotton might not prevent a war, but just change its timing and character.
That's a really good point. Okay, so if the economic lever is that unpredictable, what about the political one? You mentioned leadership. Let's talk about the actual plan that was on the table at the very beginning. General Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan.
Right. The plan to essentially suffocate the South with a naval blockade rather than invade it with massive armies. A war of constriction, not annihilation. Lincoln adopted parts of it, but opted for a much more aggressive, active strategy.
But what if he hadn't? What if the North's entire strategy from day one was, we are going to park our navy off your coast, and we are going to wait. No Bull Run, no Antietam, just a slow, grinding economic squeeze. It would have meant a longer, less bloody conflict, perhaps.
I'm skeptical that the political will would have existed for that on either side. The North was clamoring for action. On to Richmond. The South was full of bravado. Could a democracy, North or South, really sustain a passive multi-year siege with no glorious battles, no clear victories?
Probably not. The public pressure would have been immense. But it represents a different path. A mindset that prioritized economic pressure over battlefield casualties. And we know the blockade, even as part of a larger war, was devastatingly effective. It shut down their ports, their exports collapsed, they couldn't get supplies. The lifeline of those blockade runners was tiny compared to what was being stopped.
I see the strategic genius in it, I do, but you're swapping one kind of horror for another. The horror of the battlefield is visceral, it's immediate. The horror of a blockade, it's slow. It's the sound of a port city starving. It's farmers watching their crops rot because they can't export them. It's a death by a thousand cuts. I wonder if that kind of silent, creeping devastation is harder for a nation to stomach than the clear-cut, if tragic, narrative of a battle.
It's a fair point, but let's be clinical for a second. The numbers. We now think the death toll was somewhere around 750,000 soldiers. Maybe higher. Two-thirds of them died from disease, not bullets. That's the result of armies in the field, of squalid camps, of overflowing hospitals. A blockade is economically brutal, no question. But does it create the conditions for 200,000 men to die of dysentery and typhoid? I don't think so. It's a different calculus of suffering.
A different calculus, yeah. But it also changes the political calculus. A big, bloody battle like Antietam creates a moment. It gives Lincoln the political capital, the moral authority, to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. It frames abolition as a military necessity. If the war is just this slow, grinding naval pressure, does that moment ever arrive?
Oh. That's the real question, isn't it? Without the constant pressure of massive armies clashing and the ever-growing casualty lists, does the moral imperative for emancipation gain the same velocity? Or does it become a bargaining chip in a decade-long negotiation?
Exactly. You could see a scenario where 5 years into a blockade, a weary North and a bankrupt South come to the table. And the deal isn't immediate, unconditional abolition. It's something else. Compensated emancipation, maybe. A promise to phase out slavery over 25 years. The South gets to save face, the North gets to declare victory and end the economic drain. but 4 million people remain in bondage for another generation.
That is a chillingly plausible scenario. You avoid the carnage of the 1860s, but you kick the can of human rights so far down the road. You essentially trade a brutal, bloody resolution for a politically palatable but morally compromised peace.
Well, it reinforces the idea that this is fundamentally an economic and political dispute, not a moral crusade. The war, for all its horror, eventually forced the North to confront the moral cancer at the heart of the nation. Lincoln's rhetoric, his second inaugural address, that comes from a place of profound suffering and sacrifice. Does he ever reach that level of clarity in a war of ledgers and shipping manifests?
I doubt it. And think about the international angle. You mentioned Britain and France. In our timeline, the Emancipation Proclamation made it politically impossible for them to side with the Confederacy. It turned it into a war against slavery, and they couldn't touch that. But in your scenario, with a slow blockade and a negotiated settlement on the table?
They might try to mediate. They could see an opportunity to broker a peace that benefits their own textile industries. They could pressure the North to accept a compromise that leaves slavery intact, just to get the cotton flowing again. It could actually empower the South diplomatically in a way the real war never did.
So the very strategy designed to isolate the South could, paradoxically, give them more international leverage. Wow. Because the crisis is never acute enough to force a moral decision from the international community. It's just a long, messy trade dispute with human beings as the central commodity.
It's a quagmire. A political and moral quagmire instead of a military one. And think about the soldiers themselves. In the real war, you had this incredible patriotism on both sides, this willingness to fight to the bitter end, as McPherson's research into their letters shows. But what are you fighting for in a blockade war? For tariff receipts? For naval superiority? Does that inspire the same level of sacrifice?
Or does it just lead to exhaustion and cynicism? You might not have 750,000 dead, but you might have a nation, North and South, that is just hollowed out. A union that is preserved on paper, but is spiritually broken, having negotiated away its own moral foundation to avoid a fight. You have to wonder which scar would have been deeper, the one from the sword or the one from the compromise.
That's the question that's going to stick with me, the scar from the compromise. Because a physical wound, a scar from a sword, it's visible. You can point to it, you can build monuments on the battlefields, you can tell the stories. But the scar from a rotten compromise, it's internal. It's a poison in the bloodstream of the nation that might not be diagnosed for another 100 years.
Right. It's the difference between a clean break and a bone that's set improperly. The nation keeps walking, but it has a permanent, painful limp. You'd have a union preserved in name only. A resentful South forced back in by economic starvation, not conviction. A North that's patting itself on the back for avoiding bloodshed, while essentially codifying slavery for another generation. What does that do to the American experiment?
It fundamentally breaks it. The Declaration of Independence becomes, well, it becomes a mockery. And think of the legal architecture. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, the Reconstruction Amendments, they were radical, revolutionary documents forged in the crucible of war. They redefined citizenship. They were paid for with 500,000 lives. You don't get those from a negotiated settlement in a stuffy room.
No, you get loopholes. You get clauses. You get a constitution that has a permanent asterisk next to the word freedom. And what does that mean for the next century? For the civil rights movement? Does it ever happen in the same way? Or is it a series of endless, violent, regional flare-ups? Because the central question was never, ever settled.
I suspect the latter. You wouldn't have a Martin Luther King Jr. appealing to the nation's founding creed, because that creed would have been officially and permanently compromised. The moral high ground would have been ceded back in the 1860s. The fight wouldn't be about fulfilling the American promise. It would be about trying to rewrite a corrupted contract.
So, in a strange, tragic way, the war, for all its unimaginable horror, was a clarifying agent. It burned away the ambiguity. It forced a choice.
It did. It was a terrible, terrible choice between two kinds of national trauma. But one path, the path of war, for all its cost, led to a resolution. A bloody, imperfect, and still contested resolution, but a resolution nonetheless. The other path, the path of peace, it looks more and more like a permanent state of moral decay.
It makes you wonder then. Our whole premise was, what if the war never happened? Thinking of it as avoiding a catastrophe. But maybe the real catastrophe would have been a nation that lacked the courage to have that fight at all. A chilling thought. And perhaps the most important one to take away from this entire exercise. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.